Thanks very much. And I guess we're here at the last day of the ESRC seminar series that's been running for 3 years. So I just wanted to very briefly reflect on that, I guess. The first one of these that I attended was in 2013, and I just recently arrived in the UK, having finished my PhD at the Asia Pacific Centre for R2P. And it's been a wonderful forum, I guess, over these last 3 years, and it's led to collaborations for myself, and I know for many other people as well. So I just wanted to thank Jason, James, Aidan, and Adrian for making this happen and bringing us all together. So I think it's a great thing. So as Linnea said, the article version of this paper came out in the European Journal of International Relations last week. So it's a co-authored piece by Jason Ralph and myself. So over recent decades, it has become more likely that the Security Council will respond to intrastate violence. Yet, as we well know, the Security Council does not always respond, and Syria being a key case in point of that at this stage. So this article asks what a focus on Security Council practices can tell us about this failure to act collectively. In doing so, we explore the practice turn in IR and how the practice turn can inform the process of implementing R2P. So by way of background, recent use of practice theory in IR has centred on ideas around competent performances, defined as patterned actions embedded in a particular organised context. By analysing competency, practice theory can bring to the fore what is often left in the background. So this is things like how negotiations are conducted, normalised interactions between diplomats, and day-to-day diplomacy. We argue, however, that the current use of practice theory is limited by the assumption that practice theory operates on a different normative plane to norm theory and to normative theory. This separation draws on a Bourdieu-inspired approach. So analysing practices in isolation from normative theory can lead to misappropriating ideas of competence, as we'll show. So in particular, Security Council practitioners deemed competent in the Bourdieu-influenced approach may actually be making it more difficult to develop the kind of collective consciousness necessary for responding to mass atrocity crimes. So the Bourdieu-influenced approach emphasises that practices are pre-reflexive, while alternative approaches to practice theory by people like Brown, Frost and Hopf argue that diplomats need to exercise practical judgment, which Jason's just referred to, on how best to achieve these normative goals. We follow this alternative approach and draw on what Mervyn Frost calls ethical competence. So Frost takes humanitarian intervention as an example, where the choice is often presented in binary terms as to intervene or not, and argues that diplomats have a responsibility to show how intervention would in fact serve the society of states and serve global norms. This is something that Simon Adams referred to yesterday as well, around looking for ways between these binary oppositions. From this, we develop the idea of R2P competence. So R2P competence calls on diplomats to use practices that will create and sustain collective responses to mass atrocity crimes. And that idea of collective responses is embedded in the R2P paragraphs of the World Summit outcome. So R2P competence involves finding ways to square the tensions between two potentially competing aims, so human protection on one side and international consensus on the other. So I'll talk you through this in three stages. Firstly, on practice theory and how it's being used in IR. A bit on the practice of penholding, so we focus on that practice in particular in this paper. And then briefly on the practice of penholding in Libya and then Syria, and what this tells us about practice theory. So there's been growing interest in practice theory within IR over the last few years, and particularly on this idea of competence. So to practice in a discipline, such as medicine, law, or diplomacy, implies the competence to do so. There are different strands of practice theory, but as it is currently being used in IR, it's particularly inspired by Bourdieu. To unpack the Bourdieu-inspired account of practice theory and its limitations, we discuss an earlier EJIR piece by Rebecca Adler-Nissen and Vincent Puglio. So this is a practice theory account of Security Council resolutions on Libya. Their focus on practices excludes normative considerations, and in doing so, they argue that the P3, that is UK, US, France, were competent because they achieved their goals. Even though in achieving those goals, they actually made it harder. It made it harder for those states to then take a leadership role on Syria. So there are two limitations we identify here around who can critique practices and also the separation between practice theory and normative theory. So there's an assumption in practice theory, as it's currently being used, that only those who have themselves practiced can assess practices, as only practitioners will have the unspoken background knowledge. This can also reinforce insider views, and then by doing so limit the capacity for external critique. So academics can access background knowledge via interviews via ethnographic study, but this is still seen as separate from normative analysis in the way practice theory is currently being used in IR. There are some limitations to this separation. We could think of it as a division of labour, where some people are looking at practices, some people are looking at normative implications, but there are risks to that separation. By separating analysis of practices from normative analysis, there is no way to determine whether change is progressive or regressive. And we draw an example in the article, a piece by Adler and Pulio, where they talk about the West as being backward. And they say, they talk about Russia as being backward. And they say, we're not labelling Russia as backward. We're just saying that other people see Russia as backward. But there's some real issues with the way this normative language is being used. So we're arguing that practice theory is taking a normative stance, even if it seeks to avoid it. Okay, so moving then to the practice of penholding. So if you're not familiar with the term, penholding is a UN term referring to the state who leads the drafting of negotiations. So literally, it's the state that holds the pen. So states can be penholders for a particular conflict like Libya or Syria, or they can be penholders for a particular thematic area such as children and armed conflict, women, peace and security, etc. So this practice was initially meant to be a division of labour. So some states would take ownership of some things to make it easier, I guess, to do the work. But it has come to represent political ownership for a topic. So as some interviewees have told us, what this can actually mean is that if the penholder doesn't write a resolution, nobody writes a resolution because they own it, so it doesn't happen. So the issue is not just about ownership, but also exclusionary ownership. So in early 2016, there were 36 issues before the Security Council that had penholders. And of those 38, 29 were held by one or more P3 member. So China actually had no penholding roles, and Russia has only a couple. There's a few that are held by elected members, but the vast majority of the drafting is being led by UK, US, France. So as described by Germany's former permanent representative to the United Nations, the one who leads, the one who presents the text, who stakes out a position early in the day, is the one who more or less determines the game. So by penholding, they're actually giving states a choice to take something or leave it, in a sense, when they might actually prefer to do something different. Our interviewees expressed much frustration with penholding practices. So Adler, Nissen and Pulio argue that permanent members were competent in the Libyan negotiations because they achieved their goals. So if our measure of competence is the diplomat achieving their goals, then we can see that the P3 did that and they were competent in Libya. So if our measure of competence is about the collective consciousness embedded in R2P, then P3 competence becomes quite questionable. As Adler, Nissen and Pulio point out, the UK mission in New York is recognised for its diplomatic skill and institutional memory. So in their framing, the UK leveraged that competency and quickly established itself as penholder on Libya. So to draft Resolution 1970, which referred Libya to the ICC, British diplomats used media and NGO framing to help overcome resistance. To draft Resolution 1973, which established the no-fly zone over Libya, the UK and France made creative use of procedures and leaked stories to the media to isolate resistant states. So in Adler, Nissen and Pulio's framing then, the British and French penholders were competent because they secured the resolutions that they wanted. So while Resolution 1970 passed unanimously, Resolution 1973 scraped through with 10 votes, 9 being the legal majority. This shows that the P3 was successful in securing enough support to pass the resolution, but given that over 90% of resolutions pass unanimously, that was actually quite a low level of support. Indeed, South Africa's affirmative vote came down to the wire, and Nigeria had already said they would vote with South Africa, so the resolution almost failed to reach that majority. Reintroducing a normative perspective into our analysis raises questions about how competent the P3 were. For example, incorporating Lebanon's suggested language on no foreign occupation is represented by Adler, Nissen and Pulio as a crafty compromise rather than as a way of securing a collective response. Likewise, using UN procedures to allow the defected Libyan ambassador to speak is represented as part of the struggle for competence rather than as a way to give voice to the Libyan people. So the way that competence is framed by Adler, Nissen and Pulio in the Bourdieuian tradition leaves us with the impression that practice is for someone, being the diplomat, rather than for something, being R2P and civilian protection. Okay, I'll move on to Syria then, because I'm running out of time. So we then turn to P3 practices on Syria and use this idea of R2P competence. Here we argue that the P3 leadership on the Syrian negotiations actually presented an obstacle. So while Russia and China bear responsibility for vetoing draft resolutions on Syria, it does not follow that the P3 necessarily exercised ethical competence in their commitment to R2P in how they negotiated draft resolutions on Syria. So Jason's already talked a little bit about this idea that Assad must go, and that was a P3 position, which wasn't actually possible, but it helped to create this narrative of Western states being on the right side of history. It did not actually help to protect Syrian civilians. So a number of our interviewees supported this position, that P3 diplomats were more interested in claiming the moral high ground than they were in negotiating a collective response. So an alternative strategy was needed to harmonise human protection with collective action. In this case, the shift came about in the form of a group of elected Security Council members taking over penholding. So a revolving group of elected members have become penholders on the humanitarian track for Syria. Our interviewees said that it was significant that they were elected members because they could break the stalemate between permanent members. They brought more creativity to the negotiations. So initially this was Australia and Luxembourg, who were subsequently replaced by New Zealand and Spain, and the third, when it was Australia and Luxembourg, they were joined by Jordan. So we call this group the P3. It's been a revolving cast though. So their work on the humanitarian track in 2013 capitalised on the recent breakthrough between Russia and the US on chemical weapons. So interviewees told us that the approach taken by the E3 was not about point scoring, but it was very firmly focused on proposals put forward by the Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs. They weren't looking to win. It wasn't about one side winning. So the E3 were able to pass two resolutions in 2014. The first demanded humanitarian access, and the second one demanded enabled humanitarian access without the consent of the Syrian government. So these initiatives were not panaceas by any means, but they did help to facilitate the delivery of humanitarian aid, and they showed that there was actually some common ground within the Security Council that no one had been able to find until that point. The E3 were initially thought to be crazy by even trying to take over this idea of penholding. It was perceived as a hostile act by permanent members at the time. However, they managed to take positive steps for the protection of civilians, which otherwise may not have occurred had the negotiations been left to the P3. So, by way of conclusion, what does all of this mean for penholding, for R2P competency, and for practice theory as it's currently being used in IR? So on penholding, the E3 penholding on the humanitarian track has faced real ongoing challenges. When Australia and Luxembourg finished their terms on the Council, the continuity of Jordan was actually crucial for continued leadership by elected members, as the P3 tried to take over again. As Nemitz found in his book, the P3 are resistant to changes in practices that would dilute their control of penholding. The analysis done by Adler, Nissen and Pulio, that is, practice theory analysis devoid of normative theory, concluded that the P3 were competent in Libya because they achieved their aims. When we add a normative lens, our idea of R2P competency, this conclusion is challenged as the P3 failed to create that idea of collective consciousness that's embedded in R2P. The importance of a normative lens is further demonstrated when we turn to the case of Syria, as P3 leadership on this issue has at times made collective responses actually harder. And then a shift in practices towards elected member leadership on penholding has in some ways enabled collective decisions aimed at protecting civilians. So practice theory, devoid of normative theory, risks reifying existing power structures, as those who are successful are deemed to be competent. Without normative theory, this success does not consider the implications of these decisions, particularly for civilians in this case. Without normative theory, we are left with the perspective that competence is for someone, being the diplomat, rather than for something, R2P and civilian protection. And I'll just say that the article is open access if you're interested in reading the whole thing.